Hello, I'm Amjad Tarus. This is number 0877, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0877. And on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Alexa Morris, who is the co-author, along with her father-in-law, Benjamin Parkett, of the book The Courtyard, a memoir. Benjamin was 9 years old during Nazi-occupied Paris when neighbors hid him and his family for 2 years. What surprised Alexa in doing the research for this book?
The kindness of the people that surrounded him and his family. And that's really, I think, unusual for a story about the Holocaust. But what I believe is special about his story is that it is defined by these profound acts of kindness. His neighbors, his community, various people in his life showed the family and acts of bravery that enabled the family to survive. That wasn't, I don't think, typical of what was happening in World War II France, but it was a really special thing about the courtyard where he grew up and where he lived and the people that surrounded him.
Patty Lee is the author of Tanya, We Have a Problem. What's this humorous book about, and who is Tanya?
Tanya is married with two kids. Her husband made a comment about his wardrobe one morning. It kind of threw a red flag for Tanya, and throughout the day she just kind of ruminated on what it was. From that moment, she decided he was cheating, and so the book spans all of the misadventures that happen with Tanya trying to figure out, or essentially catch her husband, cheating. It's kind of laugh out loud funny, and it's also, you know, there's some emotional arcs in there too, some growing things that happen with characters when they realize that things could be going a different way.
Kathy Nesbitt is an entrepreneur who teaches laughter yoga and who has also started a worm emporium called Kathy's Crawly Composters. Did she ever think she would be an entrepreneur?
No, I was a secretary for 20 years. I thought that was my lot in life. I grew up in the 60s, and the message I received, there was probably not a memo, but what I remember was that, you know, women could do only a few jobs, like waitress, stewardess, nurse, teacher, or secretary. So I'm like, okay, of that limited list, I'll be a secretary. I took all those courses, and I was a great secretary. As a people pleaser, tell me what to do and I'll do it. I didn't even know that being an entrepreneur was an option.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, dad joke theater, Sir Dudley's Poetry Corner, a morning shower thought, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0877, was Amjad Tadros, author of The Fixer, a journalist's accidental journey through the Middle East. He was a Middle East fixer and journalist for CBS's 60 Minutes, and he was a guest on the show back on 0870, which you can go and hear that interview and see what that's all about. Thank you very much, Amjad, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff. New York police are investigating social media videos showing groups of men climbing out of manholes in Brooklyn neighborhoods, though officials say there's no threat to the public. The videos, posted last week, show men not affiliated with public works crews emerging from sewers at around 2 a.m. near McDonald and Bedford Avenues. In one incident, seven men in coveralls climbed out after a man in white lifted a manhole cover. Another video shows a man in red opening a cover from below near Hayward Street, followed by six others carrying shovels and headlamps. Police believe the group is scouring the system for valuables that get into the sewage. NYPD Emergency Services Unit officers searched the sewer system and found nothing dangerous, and there was no reported equipment damage. Well, maybe they're just Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Cowabunga! Ride 'em, turtles!
A loose parakeet has terrorized residents near the Scottish suburb of Inverness since February by attacking cars and causing thousands of dollars in damage. The escaped pet targets rubber components, including window seals and windshield wipers, prompting locals to cover vehicles with tarps. Said resident Kathleen McKinnon, "Parakeet is not a good word around here in Inverness." Neighbor Chris Ann Robertson said the bird disappears for weeks before returning unexpectedly. "You'll hear a shout of, 'He's back again!'" Nature Scott experts offer three theories for the destructive behavior: defending territory against reflections, craving fats or minerals in rubber, or simply boredom-driven exploration. Officials believe this bird escaped captivity or was abandoned by its owner. Well, I hate to say it because regular listeners to this show know how I feel about them, but perhaps what this neighborhood needs is more cats. It was graduation day for kindergartners at the Queen of Apostles School in Toledo, Ohio, but some people didn't agree about who should sit where. They got into a fight, such a big fight that one adult was taken to a hospital and another to jail. No students were hurt or involved or even present. The school went into lockdown and postponed graduation. If you're too old for kindergarten, where can you go to work on using your words?
The Stuff File program presents asinine situations that make you want to scream into a pillow.
In Lake Park, Florida, a man walked into a collectibles store just browsing for hours, but left without buying anything. Michael Basilicato, the owner of the collectibles store, then watched footage of the store's security cameras, which caught what happened after the store was closed. The man tried to break in at 1:30 a.m. by throwing a rock through the front window. But the hurricane-reinforced glass would not break even after repeated attempts. According to investigators, when that didn't work, 33-year-old Clayton Andrew Warren returned roughly 90 minutes later with a battery-powered saw and cut his way through the glass. He then went in for what he had been looking at, between $10,000 and $15,000 worth of Pokemon cards. Said the owner, "Some cards are worth millions, and that's why, unfortunately, we are getting targeted by thieves." Warren, of West Palm Beach, was arrested and charged with burglary and grand theft. Investigators traced him thanks to the license plate on the getaway vehicle, his mother's SUV. Just a guess on my part, but did they find him in her basement, hiding under his bed?
This has been the Stuff File program, asinine situations that make you want to scream into a pillow.
And let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Alexa Morris is the co-author of The Courtyard, a memoir. It's a book that she wrote with her father-in-law, Benjamin Parkett, about the 2 years his neighbors banded together to hide him and his family during the Nazi occupation of Paris. Alexa joins us from Northern California via Riverside.com. Hi, Alexa.
Hi, Peter. It's great to meet you.
Great to have you on the program. When it comes to the people who are Holocaust survivors, there are usually two groups: those who do not want to talk about it at all and those who are willing to talk about it. Which was your father-in-law? And if he's the former, did you have to kind of pry it out of him?
He was very willing to share his story. He actually is a member of a Hidden Children organization, which is a group of other people who were hidden during the Holocaust. He had his story recorded also as an oral history by the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. So he was very willing to share his story. At the same time, there were definitely components of it that were hard for him to talk about. And I don't know that I pried it out of him, but it did take over 10 years of conversation and questions to really pull out the entire story.
Okay, so there's one thing about talking about the situation. There's another thing about documenting it and putting it in a book. Did you have to convince him of that?
No, actually, he had always wanted to write it. He had always wanted to write a book about his life. I think he wanted to leave it for his, you know, his children, his grandchildren, the generations to come. And it was actually that he had started to write the book, but was struggling for how to do it, about how to do it. And my partner put us together and said, look, Alexa is a good writer. She can help you do this. And you have a story to tell. And the two of you can do this together. And she was right. It was a really good match.
So while you heard the stories about his involvement in the Holocaust, were you surprised at any of the stories that you learned about once you started writing the book?
I think what really surprised me as I learned more about all of the people involved in his life story, really, and especially during the really dark times where they were in hiding during World War II, was the kindness of the people that surrounded him and his family. And that's really, I think, unusual for a story about the Holocaust. But what I believe is special about his story is that it is defined by these profound acts of kindness that his neighbors, his community, that various people in his life showed the family, and acts of bravery that enabled the family to survive. That wasn't, I don't think, typical of what was happening in World War II France, but it was a really special thing about the courtyard where he grew up and where he lived and the people that surrounded him.
And in your estimation, or in his estimation, what types of things did that kindness instill in his personality as he grew up?
Oh, that's such a great question. I mean, he's an incredibly generous, kind human being. He's so warm. I think, one thing that I think is really stands out to me about him is that compared to many Holocaust survivors, while he carries that trauma and sadness in him, he, because he was insulated and protected from the worst of it, doesn't have the same kind of scars that many survivors have. He does, however, carry with him a real fundamental, in his bones, kind of understanding that things can go horribly wrong. You know, as somebody who's borne witness to some pretty horrific events in history, he sees that things can go wrong. I don't think exactly an answer to your question, but one of the things that also was really, I think that he got from being in hiding is an incredible love of the outdoors. I mean, he's 92 years old now, but well through his 70s, he could outbike and outhike any of us. He just, I think maybe from being inside in a, you know, a warehouse the size of a single car garage for over 2 years, he developed this incredible passion for being out in nature and enjoying the world and living to its fullest.
As you say, he can always think about what can possibly go wrong because it has in his past. Do you think he's an optimistic person or a pessimistic person?
I think he is... he's a mix of both. I don't think he's a pessimistic person for sure. I think he really has this infectious zest for life. So he comes across as he's very gregarious. He comes across as an incredibly optimistic person, and he can make the best out of every situation. And there's a just a, you know, a dose of wariness as well. But I wouldn't say it's pessimism.
Let's talk about the time period. During what time was he hidden in the occupation? And also, at what age was he?
So they went into hiding in July of 1942 in Paris. Paris had been occupied by the Germans in June of 1940, I believe, is when they came and took over. Paris and France was divided in half. When they actually went into hiding, he was 9 years old. So he was a pretty young boy. He was 11 when they emerged. They were warned by a neighbor of theirs who worked at the police station, and she saw that the family was scheduled to be arrested in what would be known as the Veldiv Roundup, a huge roundup of families. And she rushed home in the middle of the day, pounded on their door, and told them that they had to flee. So they went into hiding then, and he missed 2 years of school, of life, just being inside. But he was the one who every day had to leave the warehouse, go outside, and actually go and get food for the family. So he was actually the only one that left once a day, every day that they were in hiding, to go to some neighboring stores to get food to bring back to his family.
The book is called The Courtyard. Tell us about the physical situation of the courtyard.
So this is it's really different than what I picture when I picture a courtyard. I used to picture, you know, sort of this romantic ivy-covered walls, really quiet. These courtyards, which are in the 11th arrondissement in Paris, are huge. That's the woodworking district in Paris, and they were constructed horses and carriages delivering lumber to them. And they are surrounded on all sides by these workshops or ateliers, I think that's how you say it.
Right.
They were mostly workplaces, but also there was one area of the buildings that was actually residential where he lived. And he lived with his family in a two-room, very small apartment there. And the neighbors that surrounded them above and below them were the neighbors who ended up banding together to protect him and his family.
Now that you've written the book along with your father-in-law, does he feel a sense of relief that he's put this book out and he's unburdened himself and also given a chance to reflect on history for others?
Yes, I think that's actually a really good way of putting it. I do feel like he feels a real sense of accomplishment and relief. I think this is something he really wanted to make sure he got done. And interestingly, he doesn't actually talk about it anymore. It's sort of, I think he feels like he put it all into the book. He's really happy and excited for me to go out and talk about it, but he has moved on to really savoring just the time he spends with his grandchildren and just enjoying life and feels like it's all there in the book, you know?
Did working on the book bring you closer together?
Yes, I think it definitely did. I mean, through the many, many conversations that we had, you know, obviously touching on some really emotional and hard things, I learned more about his life than honestly his children had heard, I think, until that time. And it made me really, I already had a lot of love and respect for him, but it only increased during this project. And I feel really honored that he chose me to work with him. And I feel very lucky to have him as my father-in-law.
And were any of the family members his direct descendants, were they surprised at the finished copy of the book?
Oh, yes. I think the whole family was surprised and really pleased. I mean, it's now being read. He has an extended family in Israel. The book isn't available in Hebrew yet, but they are slowly going through the English version. So all of the extended family is reading it and really, I think, really enjoying it. I'm very proud of it. It was a finalist for the National Jewish Book Award. His youngest grandchild, who now is, I think, 10 years old, did a book report on the courtyard, and it brought it to his school where his teacher read it and is sharing it. So it's really moving through the generations in a way that's quite beautiful.
Well, speaking of moving through the generations, I mean, his grandson is 10 years old, which is exactly the same age he was in the courtyard.
Exactly. That's really it. That was not lost on us. We took a picture of the two of them together, actually, because it's such an incredibly, when the book was published, it was such a stark, like this little boy, you know, my youngest nephew is, it's really hard when you see a child that age to think, wow, at his age, Ben was carrying the weight of, you know, bringing back food to his family, enduring all that he endured. And it's very real when you look at a 10-year-old and imagine that.
Well, congratulations on the book. As the saying goes, we should never forget. The book is The Courtyard, a memoir. Alexa, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you so much, Peter. It was really a pleasure.
Alexa Morris, the co-author, along with Benjamin Parkett, of The Courtyard, a memoir. You can go to our website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0877, and you'll find links to Alexa's website, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order their book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
And now, Dad Joke Theater.
What's the definition of a shotgun wedding? It's a case of wife or death.
Join us again for another Stuff File program, Dad Joke Theater.
There's still more guests, more news, and an idiot of the day coming your way on the Stuff File program. Stay tuned. The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
I'm standing in awe and admiration for Canada. Hello, this is Peter Mansbridge. It's a reporter's duty to be unbiased, but I'm so proud of Canadians everywhere, standing united, buying Canadian products, supporting Canadian businesses, and our very way of life. Shop as if your country depends on it. Keep your money in Canada for Canada.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that's finger-licking good, if you're into that sort of thing.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to the author of Tanya, We Have a Problem. Plus, Kathy Nesbitt is the owner of Kathy's Crawley Composters. We also have a Sir Dudley Poetry Corner, Morning Shower Thoughts, and, of course, an Idiot of the Day, and much more in Stuff File News right here, right now. Flixbus has restored Poland's controversial Route 666, connecting Krakow to the Baltic coastal town of Hel via the highway to Hel. And by the way, the town of Hel is spelt with just one L, but it's pronounced the same way. The previous operator discontinued the number in 2023 following pressure from religious conservatives who accused the company of spreading Satanism. The route was renumbered 669 before being eliminated entirely. Flixbus spokesperson Alexander Kalenik told Polish media that 666 was deliberately chosen as a marketing communication element intended to increase the visibility of the connection on the popular holiday route to Hel. The 13-hour daily service travels through Warsaw and other cities before reaching Hel, a resort destination on the Hel Peninsula tip. Despite its ominous name, the town features clear waters, sandy beaches, historic architecture, and a seal sanctuary, making it a popular vacation spot. Well, it must be a smooth ride because, as you know, the road to Hel is always paved with good intentions. A Pennsylvania volunteer firefighter faces arson charges after allegedly setting three fires within 30 hours, then responding to help extinguish two of them. 29-year-old Justin Scholey of Sauterton and a member of the Perseverance Volunteer Fire Company is accused of torching a roadside woodpile in Franconia Township, a detached garage and barn near his former boss's home in Sauterton, and a Franconia property where a barn, vehicles, and outbuildings burned. Montgomery County prosecutors say 18 people were inside homes near two of the fires, though no injuries occurred. State police connected Scholey's 2015 Ford Edge to all three scenes through license plate readers and surveillance footage. During questioning, Scholey allegedly confessed and admitted responding to his fire company to two incidents. Investigators found fire-starting material in his vehicle and garage. I don't know why he didn't show up to fight the third fire, but the old mystery trope apparently stands, as for two-thirds of the time, this criminal returned to the scene of his crime.
Greetings, passengers, to another Stuff File program installment of Idiots in Flight. This is the pre-boarding announcement. We are now inviting those passengers who are complete half-wits to begin boarding at this time. Thank you.
A Frontier Airlines flight headed to Chicago on May 31st had to be diverted to Miami International Airport because a passenger choked an off-duty flight attendant shortly after he tried to open an emergency door and enter the cockpit. 51-year-old Juan Gabriel Reyes has been charged with interference with flight crew members and attendants and assault within maritime and territorial jurisdiction. Reyes became disruptive about 45 minutes after the flight departed from San Juan, Puerto Rico, en route to Chicago O'Hare International Airport, saying he wanted to get off the plane and tried to open an emergency exit door. After he was prevented from opening the door, Reyes approached the cockpit and began shoving his shoulder aggressively on the pilot's door. As a flight attendant ushered him away from the door and let him use the restroom on the way back to his seat, Reyes attempted to urinate on the bathroom floor. He was escorted to a new seat and an off-duty flight attendant volunteered to sit in his row. Reyes tried to grab the man's bag off the floor. When he asked Reyes to stop and moved to a seat across the aisle, Reyes got on top of the victim, grabbing him by the head and choking him. Several passengers worked together with on-duty flight attendants to restrain Reyes with flex cuffs, which he broke out of several times, and seatbelt extenders. Josh Longgood, a Brazilian jiu-jitsu instructor, was one of the passengers who helped restrain Reyes. Reyes was taken into custody by the Miami-Dade Sheriff's Office and turned over to the FBI for questioning. The flight continued to Chicago a few hours later. By the way, this incident came as the FAA has received 687 reports of unruly passengers this year. I guess the friendly skies currently aren't that friendly.
Here's a warning to some passengers. The air marshals are getting creative. For most of the flight, you might have zip-tied limbs and you may be duct-taped in an overhead bin until your diverted destination. But the Stuff File program appreciates you. Thank you.
And now, this.
The Stuff File presents Sir Dudley Piddley Havisham Sedgwick Smythe's Poetry Corner.
A crossword compiler named Moss, who found himself quite at a loss. When asked, why so blue? Said, I haven't a clue. I'm too down to put one across.
And let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Award-winning author Patty Lee has a new novel out with a very catchy title. It's called Tanya, We Have a Problem. Patty joins us from Vermont via Riverside.com. Hi, Patty.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on today. I appreciate it. I'm so excited to be here.
Thanks for being on the program with us. First of all, I've got to start with that title. When you start writing. Do you have a title in mind, or do you come up with a title after you finish the book?
You know, that is such an interesting question, especially for this book, because this book, I think, had 5 working titles. So the answer to that question is no, I never know what the title is going to be of the book. I write the story, and then at some point during the writing process, a title will come to me. But with this story, it really took several titles for the story to actually land, for the title to actually land. And this one finally landed, and I was like, this is the one. This makes sense.
How did you decide the one, and what were the other 4?
Well, working titles are always listed in my files as, you know, XYZ working title. So this was, it started off as Tanya, just Tanya, because that's the main character. And so that, in my mind, that's the title. And I knew with this book, I actually knew, though, that I wanted the title to include the character's name. In my first book, between February and November, that title came to me specifically through the process of the writing. And so when I came on to do this book, I thought to myself, it would be really, really great and helpful and, you know, show a little more about the book if I do something with the name of the character in the title. So then it was, you know, How to Catch a Cheater. I can't even think of all the names that I had in here, but I finally landed on Tanya, We Have a Problem. Because it made the most sense, because Tanya in and of herself creates problems unwittingly. She doesn't mean to, but it is throughout the book she has a problem, and that's kind of a tagline. One of her ride or die is Bonnie in the story, and Tanya will reach out to Bonnie, and Bonnie will say, is this another one of those we have a problem moments? And it is, and it is Tanya, We Have a Problem. So Tanya says that to herself a lot. Tanya, We Have a Problem.
What is the story about?
So Tanya is married with 2 kids, and her husband had made a comment about his wardrobe one morning, and it kind of threw a red flag for Tanya. And throughout the day, she just kind of ruminated on what it was. And from that moment, she decided he was cheating. And so the book spans all of the misadventures that happen with Tanya trying to figure out catch her husband cheating. It's kind of laugh out loud funny, and it's also, you know, there's some emotional arcs in there too, some growing things that happen with characters when they realize that things could be going a different way. And I really had a great time writing it. It was really a lot of fun.
Well, how did you come up with the idea in the first place?
You know, that's so interesting. So one of my shticks is I write about things that can happen to anyone. This story has some grains of truth to it I write about things that can happen to anyone, and it could be things that I've overheard, it could be things that people have told me, it could be things that have happened to myself personally. So this story stemmed from a grain of truth from an event.
Got you. Now, you also mentioned that Tanya's ride or die goes along with her. I get the sense that since this is comedic in nature, that this is kind of a Lucy and Ethel kind of thing.
So interesting you say that. Yes, it absolutely is. And that's actually referenced in the book. Bonnie actually says, she has a line that she says to Tanya is, as long as you realize that you're Lucy and I'm Ethel in this scenario, I'm good with it. Because, you know, we all know Lucy was the crazy one and Ethel was just like trying to keep her grounded a little bit. Although sometimes, you know, Ethel was a little crazy herself. But yeah, definitely have some Lucy and Ethel moments. There were some stakeouts. There was a, you know, crazy night where Tanya woke up and in her own bed, and the man beside her is not her husband, and so she needed Bonnie to help her figure that situation out. So it's there's a lot of fun things that happen in the book, a lot of funny things that happen in the book, and, you know, also some revelations.
In your previous book, between February and November, that's a story that delves with a long-term marriage, and we know what the story is in Tanya, We've Got a Problem. What I want to know is, you've been married for almost 40 years. What does your husband think of this?
Oh, he loves it. He supports me 1,000,000%. Writing came late to me. I didn't start writing until I was in my 50s. I think I was 50 when I started. And it just, my brain has always worked. If I see someone in the grocery store, and I've actually done this with my husband, and I'm like, you know, so they're going on a date tonight and they're picking out shrimp and lobster because they're trying to impress their date. What do you think they're doing? That kind of thing. So he knows I've always had these like stories about people in my head. And I just decided I was going to write the story. And it's interesting because when I set out to write that first time, the book I wanted to write was the Tanya book. So I'd started with this kind of, again, basing on my own marriage of almost 40 years, right? But my original thought was, I want to write about, you know, because, you know, you're married a long time, your husband's going to get on your nerves, or your wife is going to get on your nerves. And sometimes it's funny. And so I was going to try to write about, you know, the funny things that happen with, you know, couples. And, you know, obviously everything isn't always funny, but I did, that was the original intention, was to write about these funny things that happen when you're married this long. And then I set out to write it, and every time I went to write, so I write probably, a few chapters here and there, and I just had these other characters, Layla and Alan, from between February and November, that just kept poking at me. And so I put the Tanya book aside, what turned out to be the Tanya book, and I wrote the between February and November book. And it is more dramatic, definitely not funny. I have no idea where it came from. Honestly, I don't. It wasn't something that I set out to write, but it was a story that I felt like I had to write.
What made you decide to wait till 50 to write your first book? And what were you doing before that?
Well, I never saw myself as a writer. I was always a reader. I even now, it's hard to, when somebody, I just saw a friend of mine, an acquaintance at the Department of Motor Vehicles, actually. And she said, oh, I heard you wrote a book. And I right away said, I did, actually, I wrote two. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, I wrote two books. I'm still getting used to it. And I never really was a writer. I would journal, you know, I would write down thoughts and feelings just to get them out, because that's how I process. Like, I like to get it out that way. I never considered myself to be an author. I did childcare in the first season of my adulthood. I did, daycare, and there was a preschool teacher, and then had my own daycare, and then I went to administration, always, you know, kind of professional office-y jobs. And my full-time gig is an office job now. I'm an executive director of a very small nonprofit here in Vermont. So writing is not any way part of my life or what I thought it would be. But I really enjoy it. And I'll tell you what, if I win the lottery, I'm sorry, my small nonprofit, but if I ever win the lottery, I would love to just spend like chunks and chunks of my days just writing. It's just, there's something freeing about writing and putting a story down, building these lives and getting a peek into these people. They're not real, but they do become real to me as a writer. And it's just such an interesting process.
You started writing with Tanya, you put that down, and then you started writing on between February and November. That book is an award-winning book. So now when you start once again on Tanya, do you feel better about yourself as a writer? Do you feel more confident as a writer now that you have a best-selling author book under your belt?
Well, I mean, I'm not a best-selling author. I wish I was. Gosh, that would be so amazing. It was an award-winning book between February and November. And, you know, I tell myself it felt good in the moment, right? And then I tell myself, you know, my husband says I don't give myself enough credit. And maybe that's true. And I mean, it probably is. I think any writer has this bit of imposter syndrome where there's always going to be a reason, like, oh, there probably weren't that many submissions for that award. Like, that's the first thing I told myself, right? So I actually wrote an essay, too, the first essay I ever submitted in a contest, and that one won. And I right away thought to myself, I was probably the only submission. And then I find out, of course, that I wasn't the only submission. There were several other submissions, very good ones, like people with master's degrees, which I don't have. So that is also a piece of my imposter syndromes. I never went to school to be a writer. Like, I never took any writing courses or writing classes. I learned everything I know on the internet through Masterclass or through, you know, reading books from Stephen King to Anne Lamott. I just did whatever I could to figure out what was the right thing to do as when it came to writing.
Yeah, but I hear when you go to the grocery store that you and your husband kind of think about what the people outside your little sphere are doing. So you are a storyteller.
I am. But you know, my husband is so funny. He makes fun of me a little bit because he always says, my short stories are so long. That's what he tells me. Your short stories are long. You got to speed it up, he says to me. So yes, I guess I am a storyteller, but it has never been intentional that I was a storyteller. I never thought about it that way.
Well, again, the book is Tanya, We've Got a Problem. Patty, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much. I super, super appreciate being here.
Patty Lee, author of Tanya, We Have a Problem. You can go to our website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0877, and you'll find links to Patty's site, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Giving you something to think about, this is Morning Shower Thoughts.
If you don't pay your exorcist, do you get repossessed?
Morning Shower Thoughts from The Stuff File program.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Here's a brief word about our show and my book. If you become a regular Patreon patron of the Stuff File program, I'll give you an e-version of my book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. It's easy to do. Just go to patreon.com and become a patron to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. So, join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. Sign up at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Pay very close attention. There could be a test later.
And still to come on the program, we will talk about Kathy's crawly composters. We do indeed have an idiot of the day, but I've got another Stuff File news story to share with you right here, right now. Researchers discovered living yeast in the gut of Utsi, the Iceman, a 5,300-year-old mummy found frozen in the Alps, and successfully used it to create sourdough bread. Lead study author Mohamed Sarhan from Hurac Research Institute said the team found four cold-adapted yeasts in the Iceman's remains that have survived sub-zero temperatures for millennia. After 3 months of experimentation, scientists produced what Sarhan called very, very good sourdough. The yeast likely entered Utsi's body shortly after his death and can survive extreme cold conditions similar to those in Antarctica. The research also revealed the mummy hosts living organisms that actively responded to their environment, making him a living biological interface between ancient and modern worlds. Now, I know that during the pandemic there was a craze for making sourdough bread. I was not part of that craze, and after hearing this story, I care even less about it now. And when you think about it, isn't that story just a little too close to cannibalism? And finally, Uber released its 10th annual Lost and Found Index, revealing the strangest items passengers forgot in rides. While phones, wallets, and keys remain most common, this year's oddities include dentures, a dishwasher, live butterflies, and a 75-gallon fish tank. The company noted increased abandonment of Lububu collectible toys, fitness equipment, vapes, and teeth. Other bizarre finds include human hair, a Donny Osmond group picture, an ankle monitor, 420 donuts, oxygen tank, mini fridge, and 20 pounds of duck sausage. Uber is launching new app features to help retrieve lost items, allowing customers to report missing belongings and request return trips from drivers. Well, I'm sure that everybody would like to get their belongings back, except the person who lost the ankle monitor.
At Uber, what moves us moves the real world.
And let's get to our last guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Kathy Nesbitt is on a mission to put worms in every living space. Oh, you might laugh about it, and Kathy's into laughing too. She teaches laughter yoga. She also started a worm empire called Kathy's Crawly Composters in 2002. She joins us from Toronto via riverside.com. Hi, Kathy.
Hello. I'm excited to be here. Oh, the Stuff Files. Yoop. Thank you.
We're excited to have you on the program. First of all, how did you start this business in 2002 of Kathy's Crawly Composters?
So I'm located just north of Toronto. And in 2002, the landfill for the Greater Toronto Area closed, and we started to export our garbage to the U.S. Almost 1,000 trucks a week.
Wow.
And I had a solution for the indoor, for the wet waste, for the food scraps.
So you created this business. How? Why? I mean, you already mentioned the why, but how?
Yeah, it's a great question. I believe I was divinely guided. I mean, why else would I start a business without repeat customers and people are giving away their worms and they hate worms? Yeah, I really believe I was divinely guided. I was just put in the right place at the right time. Several things happened to open my eyes to the value of worms. And yeah, and as an avid gardener and composter, I knew the value of the compost, but I also didn't want worms in my house. And now it's my life.
Were you into worms before you started the business, or did you have just an idea, an aha moment?
I had an experience in 93 when I bought my house out of Toronto. A teacher friend asked me to look after her worm bin for the summer. And I was like, I did, because I wanted the black gold, the poop. but I didn't want worms in my house. So I took on the challenge. At the end of the summer, it was, you know, I put on big gloves to separate the worms. And I said, I'm never doing this again. And then in 2000, I graduated, got my psych degree, and I got a job at a group home with challenged adults. And they had 10 homes and a farm, and they didn't compost. And yeah, so several things happened, and then the landfill closed, and I just was like, okay, I need to step up and do this. So weird.
Okay, I'm a city kid through and through, so I've never heard the term worm bin.
Okay. Yeah, this is just same as outdoor composting, but done inside with the worms. And so any container will do, like a Rubbermaid or any plastic tote. And it's creating the right environment. They eat our food scraps and our paper. They need carbon and nitrogen, and they turn it into nutrient-rich soil for our gardens. It's plant food.
Yet another use for Tupperware. Tell us a little bit about laughter yoga.
Yeah, so 2012, one more person, 10 years into my worm mission, one more person said, ew, worms in the house. Oh my gosh, I'd heard it hundreds of times, but I wasn't listening. I was like, no, you need this, without realizing people don't buy what they need, they buy what they want, and they definitely didn't want what I was flogging. That day in 2012, I was like, what am I going to do if people are still saying, ew, how do I get the message out? How do I keep on building to put worms in every living space? And the very next day, I was introduced to laughter yoga. Laughter yoga is not doing yoga and laughing. It's laughing as a cardiovascular workout. Ever heard that laughter is the best medicine?
Oh, absolutely.
Right? My next question is, have you had your daily dose? Dopamine, oxytocin, serotonin, and endorphins, the love drugs. That's what we secrete when we're laughing.
I laugh every day, all day.
I'm looking forward to Dad Joke Theater, by the way. I love dad jokes.
It sounds like you're a very entrepreneurial person.
I'm something.
No, but seriously, were you ever in a situation where you had a full-time, daytime job, or did you just go where the spirit takes you and you're very entrepreneurial that way?
Great question. No, I was a secretary for 20 years. I thought that was my lot in life. I grew up in the 60s, and the message I received, there was probably not a memo, but what I remember was that, you know, women could do only a few jobs, like waitress, stewardess, nurse, teacher, or secretary. So I'm like, okay, of that limited list, I'll be a secretary. I took all those courses, and I was a great secretary. Because I, you know, as a people pleaser, tell me what to do and I'll do it. I didn't even know that being an entrepreneur was an option.
In retrospect, when you, since you are so entrepreneurial, do you think that your skills as a secretary really helped in what you're doing, what you have been doing through the course of your life?
Absolutely. Yes. All those skills, everything that we do is transferable, which they don't teach us. I didn't know. You know, a job would come up, say, in the marketing department, and people would be like, oh, you should apply for that job. And I'd say, oh, I don't know anything about marketing or customer service. I mean, are you kidding? I was the president's secretary at Bulova Watch. I was the gatekeeper. If you wanted to the president, you'd better be nice to me. So absolutely, keyboarding, what a great skill, like learning how to type. Now I don't have to look at the keys. I know where the letters are.
Absolutely. Now, you also have a YouTube page, which is Kathy Laughter. What's on the YouTube page and what can we find when we go there?
Well, there's a lot of stuff about worms, of course. And I started a video series called Fun Fab Fridays during the cuckoo time. And every Friday, a new episode. I think we're at episode 257 or something. That's a lot of Fridays. They're just little shorts for fun. Just, I really want people to feel good. I want people to care about the planet. But when we're in a mental crisis, it's not possible, which is why I'm now focused on mental health and laughing for the health of it. I incorporate a lot of different healing modalities. So my video series is literally shorts for fun, just me being ridiculous, going to different cities and doing a little expose on the town.
You know, people listening to you, they would get the impression that you've never had a single bad day. And I'm assuming that that's quite the opposite, because I feel that you have risen above whatever was in your past or in your life through laughter.
Yes. You know, before I was introduced to laughter, I, on a certain level, when somebody said, ew, worms in the house, I took it personal. You know, it's kind of my baby, and I really believe that everybody needs it, because everybody eats and creates food waste. So laughter gave me permission to not take it personal anymore. I became more resilient, more joyful for sure, and able to shift my energy in a very fast way through laughter techniques.
In your business, in your worm empire called Kathy's Crawly Composters, how can people reach out to you, and what do you have to offer to them on a regular basis?
So for the worms, I do worm workshops. I go into schools. I'll set them up with a worm composter so that the students can, you know, they have a apple core, they toss it in the worm bin, and they can see the whole process. It's really an incredible education. I go into corporations to help them set up to manage their wet waste. I do a lot of speaking now because I'm really focused on the mental health aspect now.
Well, it's pretty fascinating indeed. And again, your YouTube page is called Kathy Laughter. You also have a site called kathysclub.com. What will people find when they go to your website?
That's where they'll find how to join my free online laughter club. It's Tuesday mornings, 9:30 a.m. Eastern, 30 minutes of super fun self-care. I incorporate tapping, brain gym, qigong, just to help people get out of stress and into joy. And we're celebrating in June of 2020 is when I started. So we're celebrating 6 years this June of our free laughter club. And I would invite everyone to come and join the Global Giggle Gang any Tuesday. Always welcome.
In this day and age, we need laughter even more so. So congratulations on what you have been doing through your worms, through your Kathy's Crawley composters, through laughter, through laughter yoga. Thank you very much, Kathy, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
I'm excited. Thank you for the opportunity.
Kathy Nesbitt, who teaches laughter yoga and is also the proud owner of a worm empire called Kathy's Crawley Composters. You can go to our website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0877, and you'll find links to Kathy's site and her YouTube page. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. And boys and girls, it's that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff I'll present, the Idiot of the Day.
A South Carolina detective's career ended after allegedly pulling his weapon on a colleague during a workplace disagreement about microwaved fish. Former Myrtle Beach officer, 46-year-old Michael DiBiase, confronted a fellow officer on May the 30th about microwaving fish and creating an unpleasant odor in the office. The situation escalated when DiBiase allegedly drew his department-issue handgun on his colleague. The Myrtle Beach Police Department immediately placed DiBiase on leave. On June the 2nd, police asked the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, or SLED, to investigate, and they charged DiBiase with pointing and presenting a firearm at a person, which is a felony offense. He was booked into county jail and released on $5,000 bond. Okay, I know this is a crime, but shouldn't fish in the microwave at a workplace also be a crime? At the very least, a fireable offense? But still, why? Oh, why would you pull a loaded gun on a police colleague at the police station in a disagreement over microwave fish? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0877. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0877. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. And you can find me on Facebook, Spoutable, Mastodon, and Blue Sky as PA Holder. Check us out on patreon.com, or you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including kdxradio.com, and over the air on stations like
World FM New Zealand,
WNRHLPFM Newport Richey, Florida,
KZZHLPFM Eureka, California,
WFNULP St. Paul, Minnesota,
CKUWFM Winnipeg,
CFMU Hamilton,
CKLU Sudbury,
Local 107.3 FM St. John,
CHSR Fredericton,
plus streaming on any streaming service your little heart desires. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Let me leave you with these words of wisdom. Never, ever juggle ice picks while standing on your waterbed.